This podcast is a special two-part series. In this first pod, I speak with Eric de Fontenay, the founder of Music Dish, and we talk about his current work, as well as the initiation of a music collective in Beijing, set up to curate and develop the talents of local bands. Eric also speaks about chaos being a leading agent of change and how this has served as a catalyst in his own life and work. So sit back and enjoy the show. Well, I'd like to welcome into this studio space on the Jane Nicola Sound Vibe Show, Eric de Fontenay. I'm absolutely pumped to have him in the studio with me. So welcome, Eric.
Hey, I'm so happy to be on Sound Vibe.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So I'm talking to you from Shanghai, the city, and speaking to you up in Beijing. Where in Beijing are you now?
Shenyunqiao. So if you land into Beijing and you take that express train into the city from the airport, the first stop is Shenyunqiao. It's on the Third Ring Road.
Right. And what's special about that area?
It's cool. It's actually, you know, it's not highfalutin. It's not like Sanlitun and et cetera. But it's actually centrally located, so it's easy to go to Dongximen, Sanlitun, nice. Gulo. So if you're involved in culture, Shijiabao. So if you're involved in culture, you're kind of like in the center of, within reach of all the places that you usually would frequent. And otherwise, it's just my neighbors are a bunch of aunties and uncles and grannies, and I love it, you know, so.
Yeah, sounds a gorgeous area. I wanted to start a little bit with where you're from.
I'm from New York, the Big Apple, Queens. Because no one in New York says they're from New York. They all say where in New York they're from or what borough at a minimum. So I'm from Queens, one of the most unique cities. I was there particularly the 80s and the 90s were the years that shaped me when I was there.
Right.
And, you know, this is the time when you think of names like CBGBs, Blondie, the Ramones, hip hop, breakdancing. I mean, the cultural significance of New York. And it's just like a city like no other city, especially of the 20th century. I think it's not what it used to be. But in the 20th century, New York has always been kind of stood out from any other city. And it's got this vibe and, you know, it's always been a city of immigrants, which I think is also something that's very particular, a global city, the financial capital of the world, the cultural capital of the world. So it's quite incredible. And, you know, New Yorkers definitely have a distinct, like Beijingers in China, have a distinct characteristics and personality and are shaped by their city.
So how did you end up in China? I mean, how did that all start? I mean, you were coming from a background in economics.
Actually, really funny. One of the quite influential clubs, Lifehouse, you would say Lifehouse in China, was started by a New Yorker called Michael Pettis. So the Lifehouse is called D22. It's often referred to as the CBGBs of China, and the labels Maybe Mars that he co-founded with the lead singer of PK14, which is kind of a legendary post-punk band. And he's actually from New York. He ran a club for a few years in New York. He's still in Beijing. He's actually, I wouldn't say an economist, financial economics. And he teaches at it's Beijing University, I believe, in Tsinghua. You often can hear him on BBC World News or some other financial, you know, world analysis talking about the Chinese economy. So I don't know, economists or economic trained people who love music seem to be attracted to Beijing. I don't know why. In my case, I came after him. So Music Dish was founded in 1997. One of the things that we were known for was very much being a media partner with a lot of the major conferences around the world, like for people who know the music industry, MIDEM, Canadian Music Week, CMJ, et cetera. And there was a music conference that was relatively new at the time called Music Matters. At the time, it was in Hong Kong. And now it's become like probably the biggest music conference. It's not even like, it's more like a South by Southwest. It's music, it's tech, it's marketing, it's digital. But at the time, it was music. And so Jasper Donut, who was the head of it, asked me if I could be a media partner of the conference. And I saw it as an opportunity to kind of explore one of my infatuations since my mom says she realized I had since I was like six, which is with East Asia, specifically with China and Japan. And so after the conference, I went to Beijing to go discover this legendary city. And I went for 10 days with a mission, which was to find out if there's any underground culture in what I refer to as the belly of the beast. You know, it's like Washington, D.C. would be the American equivalent of the belly of the beast, the center of power. And I definitely found, I was completely blown away by the amount of, you know, underground culture and cultural innovation that I found. And that somewhat immediately inspired me to launch Music Dish China, which at the time was just like a new division within Music Dish that would explore the Chinese market for the outside world. But of course, that I always say China's like Alice in Wonderland, who goes into the rabbit hole and wonders how far does it go? And then the answer is, who knows? I can't see the opening anymore. I'm so far into it. So, yeah.
Was it easy to set up? Because I don't know, when I've spoken to some people who came out here 20, 30 years ago, they spoke about that they had to stay in a 5-star hotel and it had to be in a certain area. And, you know, it was quite strict regulations. This was Shanghai. But was it easy to get set up?
I thought that China would be impossibly hard. And so I didn't go with the concept of, oh, this will be easy, you know. And I think a lot of foreigners who go to China come with this idea of, oh, it's going to be easy. And there is this thing, you know, of what we would call Laowai privilege or foreigner privilege idea that, oh, foreigners are treated better and et cetera. And so whatever challenges I found, I just like, well, yeah, of course. And so I never thought it was difficult. Now that I'm not saying it's not difficult. I just think your attitude can very much, you know, your mindset can very much influence how you approach things. And you know, what difficulty level and how much you're, you know, accepting and use a little ingenuity to get what you want done. So if you think things are going to be easy, you're going to be like, oh, it was so hard. If you think from the beginning things are hard, you go like, oh, it wasn't that bad.
Another aspect that I wanted to ask you is which, before we get into your work, is which parts of China do you most enjoy? You've spoken a lot about Beijing, but have you traveled around to other parts? And what do you think?
Well, I mean, I've toured a lot of international bands in China. So by definition, I've seen more of China than I've seen of America or most other countries, actually, that I've visited. So I've seen a lot, you know, north, south, east, west, center. Beijing is, well, kind of like China's New York. Beijing is Beijing. There is no substitute. Another part of China that really is fascinating is Yunnan province. I have to refer to the province and not a specific city because that's the point of Yunnan province. It's so diverse. It has the most ethnic minorities, as the Chinese would refer to them. So this would be non-Han people. It has the most ethnic minorities of any province by far. It ranges from the mountains of the Himalayas or, you know, that mountain range. It ranges from that in Tibet all the way to the tropical forest that, you know, border Myanmar. So the food reflects that, the people reflect that, and, you know, the culture. It's Dali, which is a place where a lot of musicians have tended to go, would refer to Dali as the Montego Bay of China, ironically enough. So I think it's a really fascinating place. And it's one that, you know, does tend to attract or used to attract a fair amount of foreigners. Other places that I really like, I think Guangzhou, Guangdong. To me, it's hard to say a favorite. Or Chengdu. Yeah. Chengdu, of course. Chengdu is a very cultural city that's lively yet laid back with great food. It's kind of hard to say a favorite part because they're all, China's kind of like, it's different from, say, America. It's more diverse than America. Regionally. Of course, America's more diverse in like having a melting pot. But regionally, it's more diverse. It's more like Europe. Like, you know, you go into another province and there's a totally different food and totally different attitude and, you know, differences in culture and et cetera. So it's hard to say a favorite because I kind of appreciate a lot of different parts of China for different reasons.
One of the questions I'd like to ask you now is about your work. You've got 9 Chinese bands signed to your label, and you're concentrating on the Chinese market now. Can you tell me a little bit about these bands?
Okay, so I should specify it's not a label. It's a music collective. So in other words, a label kind of like deals a lot with copyright. We're dealing with artist development. And in this case, all of these bands are what we call COVID bands. Meaning they're new emerging bands that emerged in the air and during the period of COVID. We're not yet in post-COVID for people outside who say, hey, we're in post-COVID. Well, in China, we're not. And these are bands that they've released their first music publicly. So that would be on one of the streaming platforms during the COVID era. So they're new, they're emerging. And so we created this collective as an incubator for these bands because, of course, they're facing unique challenges compared to bands previously pre-COVID in that touring is very difficult. Even doing shows is very difficult. You know, you may think, oh, now things have gotten better and all of a sudden they get worse. And also because the Chinese music market is very top down, right? It's funny. Creativity-wise, it's very bottom up. There's a huge grassroots indie underground scene, but the business is bottom down. So if you look at the West, which would include Europe, UK, Australia, US, Canada, and et cetera, you have a whole DIY industry from SoundCloud to Reverb Nation to, you know, TuneCore, CD Baby, all these, the literally thousands of companies that developed to help independent artists basically build their careers. And in China, no. You basically have big players, whether it's on the label side, Modern Sky, that really dominates, or whether it's NetEase, WeCloud Music, Tencent. So there's not really a lot of support mechanisms for new bands. And so we thought the music collective would be really a way to bring those advantages or try to bring those advantages that Western bands have to China. And so that's why we created it, launched it. And actually tonight I'll be signing our 10th band. And our target is to sign 25 before the end of the year. We're well on track to do that. And these are all curate the bands. We do see the company's DNA is in curation. And so, but they're all young bands that are really, we think, I spoke about Michael Pettis, and he is part of what was an indie boom in China in the mid-2000s. A lot of the bands that people know about are from that period. And then after that, it became a trickle. So this is very different from the UK and the US, where it's just wave after wave after wave after wave of new music and new bands. It never stops, it never ends. Here, it was like a trickle.
Right.
And maybe around 2017, 2018 was when a new wave started of like new bands just emerging, like so many. And that didn't stop with COVID. It's not like, oh, you know, COVID kind of kneecapped this wave. No, it has continued. And so we really felt a need to support that because I think for a healthy music industry, you always need it's important having a continual injection of new talent and new sounds and not rely on that legacy artists and music alone.
So is this, you spoke about the key players and fostering and nurturing. Would that be through live performances? What are your sort of aims and hopes for these bands, for where you want to take them?
Music Dishes, you know, our DNA. Our DNA is a lot over the last 25 years as a media company.
Yeah.
We used to be a music industry publisher. We used to publish like 12 newsletters every week back in the day. Coming to China, I did bring that. And so we've built very strong and active media channels in China. So one of the first things is just leveraging those to create a lot more exposure and awareness for these bands. Because if you're a band, that's the hardest thing, is to get people to notice you. And I think, you know, bands in the States can definitely relate because it's just so much supply of new music. I think there's 100,000 songs uploaded to Spotify every day. So they can relate to how hard it is in that environment to get noticed. And in China, we don't have the same volume, but we don't have the same online ecosystem either. So one of the things is that, and that's at a core, promotion, marketing. The other thing is, of course, and I see three stools, is events, you know. So whether it's events that we create, or and we've already kicked off a whole series of events, you know, to provide and to leverage our marketing muscle to have them playing for much bigger audiences than they would. So kind of like a jump kick. Finally, the thing is, we're also going to be building an outer network for the collective of like supporting stakeholders. And these could be rehearsal and recording studios, photographers, videographers, fashion designers, graphic designers, all the kind of players who we've already vetted and who we can negotiate to have a deal, because we're bringing a network of artists. We're not, you know, talking about one artist. We're saying, if you want access to this network, this collective, you know, let's negotiate. And that we'll be able to support. So like if a band needs a tour poster, they can easily access professional graphic designers. If they need to do a photo shoot, they can access top photographers and et cetera. So that's another piece of it.
You, and it's been going around in my mind, you spoke about the word subversive and that, you know, you often create from chaos. And I thought this was fascinating just because, well, I think you realize I've also got a background in education. So I'm working with a lot of kids and up and coming groups who often say, oh, well, you know, no, I can't do that because, and this is happening because, which is partly due to COVID and also sort of many of the clampdowns that have come around.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's more like it's a handicap I had to deal with. So like when I was young, like even in high school, and especially when I got to college and did like, you know, when I was in late high school and early college, I was doing temp jobs, work in a copy room, do this. And I just realized, you know, I can't do this. I can't take orders from an idiot who's telling me to do something that I know is stupid. Yeah, my mom always said I had a rebellious streak. How did I reconcile with that was like, well, okay, if I can't, then I got to figure out what I can do. And that was like creating my own rules. And so ironically, like coming out of college, I became a partner just coming out of college with a consulting firm. And so I had a lot of freedom to dictate what I wanted to do. And then right after that, or during that period, I started my own business, and I've been running my own business and different side businesses since then. And that gives me the opportunity to be able to set my own rules. And that's kind of a little part of chaos. But I think it was also, you know, I started the company in 97, which was the dot-com boom. This was the beginning of the web, actually, that period of the beginning of the web. And then that meant that I had to live through the dot-com crash. And if anybody's involved in crypto now with the FTX bankruptcy and all that, you're getting a little glimpse of what the dot-com crash was, except it was worse. And that was kind of my first taste of, well, no, my first taste of chaos was New York City in the 80s and 90s. New York City was chaos, and I loved it. But that was my first taste with business. And over the years, what I realized is I actually thrive in chaos.
Yeah.
Because in chaos is when you have room to reshape the rules, right? Mm. That's okay. Order, you don't. In order, when there's order, you know, you the rules are very strictly applied and reinforced by society. But when there's chaos, all the rules go out the table and the people. So, but I want to distinguish. I think there's I love Heath Ledger's Joker, because in the scene when he's with Two-Face, he goes and he says, "I'm an agent of chaos." The thing about chaos, it's fear.
Hmm.
And to what you were saying, for most people, most people have a choice in life. It's either security or it's freedom, right? Do I do what I really love? Or do I get a job that gives me a guaranteed salary? And 99% of people choose security.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very few will choose freedom, because mm-hmm. freedom is scary, real mm-hmm. freedom. I mean, just like leaving your home, going to another country, you know, like mm-hmm. you're from the UK, I'm from the States, we went to China. You know, as you said, a lot of people say it's difficult. There's some embedded fear. Can I make it? Can I hack it? What's going to happen? I don't know. And for me, I thrive off that. And so, and I think, you know, you spoke of education. I also lecture at Communications University of China. And I always try to ingrain in my graduate and undergrad, actually this semester I'm teaching some PhD. And I always try to ingrain, you know, oh, how chaos has created opportunity in the music industry, mm. right? Since the web, and how chaos is good, but how you have to really, how do you frame your mind because to be in an environment that is chaos? Because I believe that, you know, over the next decades, we're going to have a lot of chaos, you know, whether it's climate change or technology, and that people just have to get accustomed to that there is chaos and then embrace the chaos. And
yeah.
I just had the fortunate thing of doing this at a really early age, because I didn't have, because I'm not able to hack it in society. That's my problem. It's not because I'm smart. It's like, you know, like I don't create chaos. I'm not Elon Musk. I would be the guy behind Elon Musk picking up the pieces and opportunities that he left behind as he's destroying stuff left and right. I essentially believe society tells everybody follow the straight road, right? Get good grades, go to college, get married, have two kids, buy a house, blah, blah, blah. Culture. And I say culture, written large, you know, could be dance, sculpture, music, whatever, tells you, take those assumptions and split them and flip them over.
Mm.
Look at the world differently. And that's why I love culture, because culture is an agent of chaos, because it makes you question. Literature has always made you question. Music makes you question. And you know, that's why we have to nurture culture and have culture being a key ingredient in education, for example, you know, because it will make people think different.
Mm. Which brings me to the word saving face, which I hadn't heard till I came here. What do you have to say about that and your bands or your interactions with people?
Well, as I told you, I'm not very good at putting up a face. That's why I couldn't work for someone, because you have to put up a face then. My attitude in China is I tell people, like, if I know I'm going to say something that's going to be disturbing, I always tell people, look, let me paraphrase this by saying, I'm a New Yorker, you know, and they go like, oh, right. And, you know, it's incredible how saying I'm a New Yorker can allow you, give you a lot of flexibility.
I wish I could say that, Eric. Spoke about outdoor events, that you've been doing them recently. And in what ways do you feel this is beneficial at the moment?
So this came about really in COVID. In the spring of this year, while Shanghai was locked down, Beijing didn't have a lock, but all the restaurants, venues, gyms, everything was closed. And so people had nothing to do. Right. It was even a lot of work, remote work and things like that. Coincidentally, the local government had totally renovated the Yangma River. And so people just started, you know, it's spring, so it starts getting warm. People just start congregating at Yangma River. And it was, to me, it's a high point of Beijing. People weren't in the malls, which, you know, malls are very popular in China. They weren't in the malls. They weren't in all the, they were just going and appreciating the outside and interacting with people they may not interact with normally. And, you know, it, it was a, people adapting to chaos, right? And in a very positive way. So for me, it felt like essential to keep that kind of spirit. And so we tried, and it's not very easy. I'm talking about performances. And it's not very easy, especially during COVID. So we started this series called The Urban Jungle Jam, which in the end got found, you know, we did it at different places. In the end, we found a home in Longfushi, which is a hip area of Beijing. It's actually an area that's controlled by a government-owned management company. And there's a bar called Mona Bar, which unfortunately will be closing this November, a victim of COVID. And so we were taking over this outdoor square for these huge jams. And I don't know if you know, like, you know, jams usually are an artist's affair. Usually, you know, you have maybe 20 to 40 people, mostly artists. And it's a place for them to meet, to basically engage musically, to practice, and et cetera. Well, these events had between like 80 and 150 people, mostly obviously being non-music people who were just appreciating this raw, maybe 20 musicians, who were just appreciating this raw, creative kind of musical, you know, performance that was happening ad hoc. It was very chaotic. But it all ran very smoothly. And people just were loving it. They, you know, the reaction that people were giving me, not the musicians, they loved it. But the other people are like, you know, I've never been to something like this. This is great. You know, we really need this during this COVID period because live houses were closed. So you couldn't go see a standard performance. And so, yeah, we did that. The last one we did was, yes, last weekend.
Nice.
And, we're kind of shutting it down. We're thinking we really want to bring it back next spring. You know, jams are never something I wanted to do. I like to go to jams from time to time. But, you know, for me, it's like I'm doing shows. You know, I do very complex orchestrated shows with markets, lots of music, film. You know, it's very multidisciplinary. And so I didn't never thought I'd ever do a jam, but, you know, we kind of did our own style of jam that really people loved, I loved. It was more Woodstocky than normal jam. I think that the setting was part of it. And so, yeah, that's what it is. And I'm seriously looking at how we can incorporate that next year so it can be something regular.
You've been listening to the Jane Nicola Sound Vibe Show, and I've been speaking with Eric DeFontenay, the founder of Music Dish. If you'd like to hear more about creators, musicians, bands, producers, writers, and composers from all over the globe, then you might like to subscribe. Thanks for hanging out with us.